Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. I am your host, Jason Miles. And if you are new to the channel, please hit the like, please hit the subscribe button, and don't forget to hit the notifications bell, as we are constantly adding new shows and we're cross-streaming all the time. Over the last week, I think we did two cross streams with Ben Burgess. That was actually was just for our patrons. As Ben let us cross stream, I was on with Teray Reed recently, and we talked about, we do a movie review every month now with Ben, and this time it was one of Teray's favorite movies, American Psycho. And then we had like a deep dive that we don't normally do, and we got to cross stream that. Also, we cross-streamed the Sublation magazine launch. That's still on our YouTube channel. And also, we got to cross-stream not too long ago a show with our homies in Germany, 99 Zu Eins. Talked about heavy music and its revolutionary capacity. Also, if you haven't checked it out, YouTube was trying to suppress it, and I did win my case, so now it's up for everyone to see with the latest video essay, Welcome to the Terror Dome, and then the subsequent recap that I did with my co-host Pascal. Speaking of my co-host, my homie, my dog, please welcome the man of the Mau Mau Hour. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat, peace and greetings to the audience, peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Good to be on the show. I miss being here as regularly as normally the case. I just want to say to our viewers, our patrons, and our chat, shout out to Jason Miles for not only holding down the fort while I was away recuperating, but for really putting out some amazing content. Jason's article on the LA riots is amazing. His cross-streaming and going on various shows, talking about various, all types of sundry types of subject matter has been amazing. You know, it's really interesting for me on this show, since Jason and I have been doing this together for coming on 2 years, that always, and Jason says all the time, oh, Pascal, you're the star of the show. And I actually kind of like to believe that we are both holding down the fort, and that this is a team effort, and it's not really about any one of us being a star. It's about us really complementing each other and being able to bring out the best of both of us, of each other, I should say. And I just want to say a compliment to my co-host and the captain of the ship of This Revolution podcast team here for really, really reaching out and expanding his reach into the interwebs and exposing not only his charm, character, good looks, and knowledge of heavy music, but really doing intellectual deep dives into subject matter and areas that normally people think the degreed smart people on this show are only able to talk about.
Well, I didn't think I was going to tear up this early in the show, but thank you very much for the, I'm being totally serious. Thank you. That means a lot. I don't have any words. This is day 9 in a row of streaming and doing all this show stuff. I was on Ben Burgess's show last night. So I look forward to the time that we're trying to schedule off in June. I'm just glad to have you back, and I'm looking forward to, oh man, you kind of messed me up. I'm definitely looking forward to your upcoming writing that we have planned, and I'm really looking forward to the Mau Mau Hour that we have planned, and of course, movie night is going to be probably one of our most fun movie nights. Coming up, we're going to be watching Hollywood Shuffle, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Also, former TIR Saturday crew member Paul Prescott is running for office in Philadelphia and or Pennsylvania. I think it's a state house he's running for, if I'm not mistaken. Right, Pascal?
That's correct.
And people are voting today. So if you guys are in the area, hopefully you vote for the homie Paul Prescott. We wish him the best. I hope I can send him a congratulations text message a little bit later this evening. So shout out to Paul Prescott. Now, before we bring in our guests, I do want to lay some things out. As our listener base is growing, many of you may not know that I've spent time unhoused, living in a van, sleeping on couches. Some longtime viewers noticed it again late last year before I was able to relocate to Mexico that I was between spots. Not only have I experienced being homeless, I also worked in one of the emergency hotels for the unhoused, similar to the ones we'll be discussing today. This is a subject that is very important and dear to me because I see many people, regardless of political ideology, that want to have simple solutions to very complex problems, often trying to imagine the perfect homeless person, like how one imagines the perfect victim, one without flaw or contradiction. Just put them in a house, not understanding the complexities of one's ability to attempt to live unsupervised. I have been in the belly of the underfunded, often ignored beast, and it fills me with rage the way many people so flippantly believe they have the answers. There was an article in the SF Chronicle about our guest and his permanent supportive housing hotels he manages in the Tenderloin area of San Francisco. For those that don't know, the Tenderloin has an extremely high concentration of the city's unhoused population. My three-year-old son and I stayed there while I was visiting him just last month, and I was blown away by the degeneration of the area. Many are severely drug addicted, violent, and mentally ill. Several have been in some form of systemized care since birth, chronically homeless, and deemed a blight on one of the richest cities in the country, a scapegoat is often looked for. For years, it was the administrations, but now it looks like the new whipping boy are the people that attempt to do so much with so little. Please welcome our returning guest, a man I have a lot of respect for, Randy Shaw.
Thank you, Jason. That was a great introduction of what we're dealing with homelessness in this country.
Go ahead,
Pastor. Randy, I'm going to say that this is an area of expertise that I often defer to Jason because I know the work that he's done with the unhoused and the amount of care he's dedicated in times of his life to trying to make sure that they're treated with respect and integrity. But I want to tell you, I read the San Francisco Chronicle article and I read your response to that article, and having had you on the guest on this show, at least on two occasions, I was quite dismayed by the accusations, the allegations, and the way in which they try to portray the work that you do for a segment of the community of this country that literally is disposed of by everyone in a way that is inhumane and frankly, basically cruel. And we're dealing with subject matter and people who are largely ill, mentally ill, many of them sick, many of them destitute because of the phase, most of them, if not all of them, destitute because of the phase of capitalism. And yet, because of the political winds that we live in today, the San Francisco Chronicle took the opportunity to do what I consider to be more than just a hit piece. If you can really outline for our audience, can you talk about how the structure of the unhoused and the government in San Francisco, using the paradigm of NGOs, nonprofits, and intermediaries as the means of funding caretaking for the unhoused, helps create perhaps part of the predicament that was discussed in that San Francisco Chronicle piece? And are there better options?
Thank you, Pascal. I will say, for those who haven't read my response to that Dishonest Chronicle story, it's at beyondchron.org, beyondchron.org, and it's up there now and you can read it. And, you know, I think one of the things that frustrated me in dealing with reporters, and I spent hours with them to no avail, I tried to have put what's going on in San Francisco and other cities into a big context, a broader context of poverty and the lack of affordable housing in America. They kept saying they weren't interested in that. They want to just talk about these very specific things. But, you know, when you mentioned about how do we house low-income people in this country, how do other countries do it? Well, other countries have public housing. The government builds housing. People pay a very low rent, and it works very well. There's also social housing where government builds housing for all income levels, including the poor. Well, when we built public housing in America, a lot of racist mayors didn't really care about quality housing. So like in Chicago, Mayor Daley said, well, build those big high rises because we'll create a lot of construction patronage jobs for me. And I don't care if people living there, I don't care if the black people living there it's not a good place to live. I just want the patronage. And yet then Cabrini Green and other big public housing projects became the symbol of failed liberal government. But the activists, people like me of that time, all said this was going to fail. Same thing happened if you see the film, I think it's available on Netflix or Amazon, Pruitt Igloo, when they tore that down in St. Louis. We tore down 100,000 public housing units in 1990 under Bill Clinton. Just think of that. Had a terrible homeless crisis, and we eliminated 100,000 housing units. That's... because supposedly the conditions were, they couldn't be repaired. So starting in the 19, homelessness really began in the late 1970s, soon after President Nixon announced that the U.S. was no longer doing public housing. And we've never done it again since. We've eliminated 100,000 units. San Francisco is a rare example of not losing any units, but almost every city used public housing demolition as an excuse to gentrify neighborhood and displace people of color. That's what the whole Clinton Hope program was about outside of San Francisco. So we come to San Francisco, and we've done a lot of very progressive things. And one of the things we did, we had a supply due to people, a number of us who fought to keep SROs from being converted and demolished in the late 70s, early 80s. We had a supply of SRO rooms for homeless single adults. And by leasing the hotels or buying the hotels and having nonprofits run them, we have transformed the lives of thousands of people. It's a national model. And yet
can you define SROs for our audience?
Yeah, single room occupancy hotels. They used to be called, it used to be the word SRO in every newspaper article would be preceded by the word seedy. Seedy SRO hotels. And as I said in my article, our hotels are all in the best shape, better shape than anyone when we acquired them. And yet the media, who wants, just like with public housing, they look for a way to attack something that they don't want to really be there. And the media is never generally, the corporate media, the Hearst Corporation, has never been supportive of preserving as residential hotels. So, you know, you see people say to me about this story written by the Hearst Corporation, like, what's their broader agenda? Why would they attack the most successful program in the nation to house homeless single adults?
Well, I mean, also we should probably add that when San Francisco took over a lot of these old dilapidated hotels at the time, that were just there, that were built after the earthquake. I mean, these things are over 100 years old. We have to remind people how old they are. Besides them not being in the best shape, a lot of times the city isn't even the owner of the place. They're just renting it on long-term leases.
Right. Well, I think, you know, what's happened is that we took the available supply. Leasing was fine. It's subsidized. And yes, there's an extreme, you know, it's come out with our workers are way underpaid. It's ridiculous because, as Pascal mentioned at the start, when cities contracted out homeless services, they basically didn't have to pay the pension benefits or the salaries of city workers.
Which is why they contracted out, right?
Well, at the time, with both AIDS funding and with homelessness, it was like, well, there's more community concern, cultural competence. Progressives were promoting those values. We were all like, we don't want the city bureaucrats doing it. We want our people. But over time, it really just becomes of a duplicate workforce that gets significantly lower pay and benefits. And that's where we are in San Francisco right now.
One of the things that we evidence in the article is that it basically takes individual examples of rather alleged low quality of life living facilities for unhoused individuals in these facilities as an endemic demonstration of how poor the caliber of life is for people who are using those facilities. And it does that sporadically throughout the article to make it seem like these places are so disheveled, they're horrific, they're rather vile, they're inhumane, they're dirty, and they're filthy. And what I found fascinating in your rebuttal is that you so easily demonstrated that if these places are so filthy, why is it that we have one of the most long-term amounts of maintenance of actually adherence to people wanting to stay in these properties? Can you talk about some of the allegations that they try to level at these facilities and your response to them, please?
And I'd even go beyond that, Pascal, and say that if you look at who are the most politically active residents of the Tenderloin neighborhood, what has made the Tenderloin so politically powerful despite our low income status? It's all SRO residents. You talk to business owners in the neighborhood, they are thrilled with SRO residents because they're the ones cleaning up the streets, working to get parks, getting murals done, supporting the people when they have problems. We build community, but none of that was mentioned in that Chronicle story. They just wanted to focus on people who had grievances about their buildings or were being evicted for not allowing exterminators in. And it really missed the amazing thing that I think we do a lot to build. We have tenant leaders in the building who work with tenants. You know, these folks in these SROs, unlike public housing, which are families, a lot of these single adults do not have a friend in the world. Mm-hmm. They're a very lonely group. We do so much to try to break through the loneliness, and it's hard. Some of these folks never leave their rooms. So when they do leave their rooms, our desk clerks say to them, "Hi, how you doing?" We have common lobbies so they can watch sports together and do activities, because the biggest problem in SRO hotels is not drugs, it's loneliness. It's loneliness. Mm. And people, most of the tenants in our hotels, the biggest demographic category is 61 to 70. So it's like senior housing. Yet the Chronicle criticized the hotels. They say the program has a lot of deaths. Well, yeah, well, we have people who are 61 to 70 and they had a life of very hard knocks. You know, you're poor and you're on the street for 10 years, it affects your life expectancy.
And also, you know, I did write some notes about the hit piece, and I don't know if people understand how easy it is to get bad news walking by a shelter. The county used to call, and they would call the hotel. And keep in mind, unlike where Randy works, the hotels that were emergency kept the hotel staff as much as they could. And so there was actually a concierge. And so the concierge answers the call, and they'd be like, "I want room 8. And the county would just be like, "Hey, how are you being treated?" They don't know who's in room 8. They don't know if the person in room 8 called us 15 times to kill invisible spiders, or if they've been hoarding trash to the ceiling, which these are all things that have actually happened. I'm not saying this flippantly. They don't know if that person stabbed another. They don't know anything. They say, "Hey, how's everything going?" And the day the county called, a whole message was sent out to every tenant. We knocked on doors because you can't just leave flyers because some people can't read. And there's 300 people in the facility, and said the water will be shut off from this time to this time because they have to fix the plumbing. So when the county calls, person in room 8, "There's no water here. They won't let me have water." So then what happens? And you get an email. "What the hell is going on here? You can't have these people without water. What are you people doing?" But, you know, and it, you know, it goes on from there. So the story that the Chronicle has starts off with a woman named Pauline Levinson, who said she had a severe rodent infestation, and it was so bad that she had to pitch a tent in her room, which kind of didn't make sense to me because that wouldn't stop rodents from getting in necessarily. But she then went on, it kind of talks about her a little bit throughout the piece that she was violent as well, but this is kind of more part of the decay of the building and has less to do with the individual, and of course the treatment of the individual. and you start your rebuttal off, well, hey, that's not necessarily what happened. So if you want to talk about
that. Well, yeah, the Chronicle framed the whole story around a tenant who's complaining about rodent and roach infestation but refuses to let exterminators in her room. The health department has pleaded with that woman to let exterminator service. If you don't let extermination service, that's where the roaches and mice are going to be. And the Chronicle knew that because I told them that she wasn't letting extermination service, but they didn't print that. They didn't tell their readers. What does that tell you about their motives? They just outright lied. She assaulted a fellow tenant. She's gotten in altercations with many tenants so many times that there's been multiple police visits to her to calm her down. And that's who is our, that's my staff's fault because of what she's doing. And I think there was this idea that this blame the nonprofit staff, blame the workers, and our workforce is 45% Black. It's a very racially diverse workforce. Many have been homeless themselves. Mm-hmm. Blame those people because she won't let extermination services in her room. That's why I wrote the story. I mean, there's so many examples. Almost everyone they quoted was someone who, we had one person they quoted saying he'd never gotten any response from case management, and our case management has records of all kinds of interactions. So the interesting thing is, I've just finished this, is that there's so many great tenants who can talk about how our buildings have transformed their lives. They didn't talk to any of them. Why not?
Well, they're not as compelling, right?
Well, and also I think it's more, they would give a positive impression. You know, one of the things in this Pruitt Igloo thing, when they justified destroying this giant public housing complex in St. Louis, they never talked about the good tenants. It was always, well, these folks are dealing drugs. But the vast majority of tenants were not. But they wanted to create an impression of to justify tearing down the building. And here, they say the program's a disaster. Well, people are outraged in the hotels because they feel it's transformed their lives. They were on the streets. We took people who are on the streets and given them permanent housing. They live the rest of their lives often in our hotels. And that's why we're very excited about expanding the program, and that's why San Francisco City's political leadership is kind of ignoring that Chronicle story.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, though, is that I found it very suspicious in terms of the timing of the Chronicle article, in that we're at a time right now where we have the kind of post-COVID economic crisis and precarity. We have inflation everywhere. We have large amounts of financial services companies that are investing in residential housing, causing a massive, massive shortage or inflation in the cost of housing. Is it possible that this hit piece is facilitating a kind of narrative about homelessness and housing in a way that helps allow further intercession of finance capital to obscure the necessity of housing for the unhoused to be a priority of government, and justify by saying this stuff can't work anyway, so let's just move on to housing that makes us profit in the end?
You know, Pascal, I've heard that from a number of people saying, you know, maybe the Chronicle wants an excuse for getting rid of these SRO hotels and just say they're so run down they shouldn't be remained. I do want to mention a point that Pedro made on the chat line, if I could, because he made a point that's really important. He said that he rents a place in the Presidio, and there's problems with rice, rodents and mice and mold. I said to the reporters, you guys don't understand, tenants throughout San Francisco have cockroaches. It's not just in permanent supportive housing. And I said, why don't you call Veritas Tenants Association, and they can tell you about the problems they have in their market rate units. They said, we're not interested in that. So it's like every building in San Francisco is completely pristine with no problems at all, except for permanent supportive housing. That's the picture they portrayed. That's just nonsense. But there is concern about a larger agenda. I will say our board of supervisors and our mayor would not let that happen. But the Hearst Corporation, people feel, is laying the groundwork for trying to change. People were feeling very positive about SRO hotels, and now they want to maybe change that. I think that's a very good point.
I do feel that same way about the changing tide to SRO hotels, because some of the hotels are near housing that's a little
more near the Hearst Corporation and Fifth and Mission.
Yeah, so in the piece, as I was reading through it, and I'm actually kind of yelling as I'm reading through it, because I know I know what it's like to work in these environments first and foremost, and I know what it's like to live in these environments second of all, and I know how hard it is to work in these environments, because the one thing that they don't really talk about is even the woman that they're depicting as the perfect homeless victim. When you have difficult tenants that not just yell at you, which becomes very, very normalized, like you, I'm sure even in your hiring process, you probably have to tell people like, hey, people are going to call you an MF-er every day. Like, you're going to be an MF-er every day to somebody. Yeah, that's a good day. Food thrown at you. Definitely people are going to try to fight you. It's a very, very tough job. And part of you has to really love it, right?
And be dedicated. And by the way, Patrick Patterson Carroll just made a comment about how you have to have pest control to stop these things right at where you live. And so the woman, the poster child, didn't they pick it? Didn't have to take pest control. That's what you get. You know, our staff worked when COVID started in 2020, residential telesphere was considered one of the highest risk environments because of their density. Our folks, our janitors, our desk clerks, our maintenance workers, they came to work every single day. Chronicle reporters stayed home. They didn't come to work for a couple of years. They worked at home. But our people came in every day. Yeah, so they're trying to say in these articles that our people aren't dedicated. They don't care. And as you said, Jason, you can't do this job if you don't care.
No.
You're not doing it for the money.
No, I was doing it when there was no vaccine. And
that's what I mean, yeah.
We the place I was at, actually, the reason why I'm here with you today full time is because the safety protocols I felt weren't up to snuff, you know, and I won't speak for Randy's facility, but other facilities have legitimate violence problems. And, you know, those things are hard to curb when you don't have resources. Someone wrote in the chat, they said something about, I got an idea, what if we had a place with mental health resources and counseling resources? Like, all that stuff costs money. And when you think about, when you say we're going to tackle homelessness, a lot of people say, well, just put them in a house. And Randy talks about this. I don't think people understand. I want to get into this with you, Randy. People understand the ability for certain people to live unsupervised. And it becomes a bit of a issue, because I don't think people understand what that looks like, because most of us go, well, you get a house and aren't you feeling better about yourself? It's like, not everybody. You're dealing with a segment of the population that is severely impoverished. So, and it's not everybody, but a lot of them. Some people have been in the foster care system for the majority of their life. Then they might have been incarcerated after that. And if you haven't really done a hardcore crime, I don't know if you guys know this terminology. Randy probably knows it. It's called wino time. If you get busted for little bullshit offenses, selling dope here, whole bunch of DUIs, this is going to sound fucked up, smacking around a significant other, you're not going to spend a lot of time in prison. So you're going to be in and out. And eventually, you're just going to be out. And you're going to be on the street. If you're a sex offender, you're going to be on the street. And that's a big part. Go ahead, Randy. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you know, one of your commenters made a point that relates to this, that, you know, one of the points I made in my interviews was that tenants are being placed in supportive housing who really cannot function in a large-scale environment. Supportive housing providers have made this point to the city for years, but because it's so expensive to find, and you have to fight with neighbors to open a facility of people who are extremely troubled, we don't do it. So we'll have a 100-room hotel, and someone will go in there who really can't function in a 100-room hotel. They need more private attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that point could have been made in the article. Instead of attacking the model of permanent supportive housing, It's like attacking a studio apartment because it can't house a family. You have to find suitable housing for every person. But this is something that San Francisco has failed on for a number of years. And I think it's really because it costs so much to create a facility, which would have to be small. Like, we used to have board and cares. They were all sold off to the city and state didn't fund them. So we lost our board and care supply. But there used to be, large houses where like there'd be 12 to 15 people living. And under those conditions, they could function very, very well. Put that same person in a 100-person hotel and they can't. So everyone would agree with what I just said, but it needs to happen. And it really takes federal money. And before we get, we don't want to end the show without people realizing all of our problems in every city is because the federal government abandoned affordable housing funding. And it's abandoned it for 40 years. And the Build Back Better bill was the first time any president, any legislation was really going to seriously tackle homelessness. And then we had Senator Joe Manchin kill it. And we're still hoping to get some money. But cities all get blamed, but they don't have the resources. We need the federal government to fund housing for the very troubled. Because San Francisco, Oakland has no money.
Oakland, I was under the impression when I left that they were going to buy the Radisson Hotel, or at least the county was.
Through home team money. That was through state money. The state funded that.
Well, last I heard, they're not buying it, and it's going back to the owner. The county is going to stop running it at the end of June, is what I heard from some people inside. Really?
Well, they did buy a number of hotels, and the governor just expanded funding for Project Home Key, which has been a big success. But most cities, San Francisco is a wealthy city. We have a $74 million budget surplus, which is plenty enough to fund adequate salaries for homeless service providers. But Oakland doesn't have money. LA doesn't have that money. So New York City has a trouble. So the federal government has to get back in the housing business. That's priority number one.
The question I want to ask you about that, though, is that you've demonstrated that over the last 40 years, public housing has been taken out of the line item agenda of the federal government. And what I want to ask is that, what is the role of funding or lack of funding for mental health services and its correlation to housing? And has it been a precipitator of or exacerbator of the problem? And what exactly are they, how do they intersect, if you will?
There's a myth that people all believe. And I always say, I hate to ever say anything good about Ronald Reagan because he was the worst president of our history and he wrecked this country. But there's always this view that it all blames all these mental health people on the streets because Reagan let him out of the mental. Reagan left the governor's office in 1974. There wasn't homelessness in 1974 in California. The federal government, when it comes to any social service or education or healthcare, has just doesn't deliver the resources this country needs. And we're a failed country for that reason. And the housing intersection is a big problem.
What exactly was the interface with mental health in terms of how it was dealt with that precipitated worsening homelessness in any way, if there is one?
Well, I think the people just didn't get the care they needed. And now they did. They've opened a respite center, and the cost is very high. And they've done a medical respite center under both Mayor Lee and Mayor Breed. But the money is so vast because people aren't cured in a week. people need a long term. Once they're over their initial trauma, where are you going to permanently house them? That's the question that our society seems to dodge. Okay, if you're older, and our people are older people, they're not going to get jobs in this market. Where are they going to live permanently? And SROs are the best place for them to live. There's no really other option.
Well, this is the thing I want to ask you to further on that question, Randy, is that one thing that Jason has always talked to me about is that how many of the people who are in these facilities suffer from emotional trauma, psychological trauma, come from abusive backgrounds, have mental health problems, have structural, psychological illnesses or mental illnesses or problems that affect their capacity to live on their own. How exactly can we create a problem, a cure for the problem of the unhoused, unless we fuse housing and turn it not so much into quote unquote just housing, but caretaking for the ill, because it seems like this is more than just housing people who need a space, but caring for a need of a community that largely probably does not have health care. If it does, probably has a poor quality of care that needs to have an intimate kind of connection with health services to take care of their capacity to even live on a day-to-day basis. Wouldn't that require a fusion of certain services beyond simply just housing?
Absolutely. And, you know, people, you may not know that Laguna Honda, the largest, you know, huge facility for people who have mental issues and health issues and seniors, it's threatened with closure because it hasn't met certain standards under COVID. And it's hard to run those facilities. You know, someone mentioned about mental health. It's true. You can have no mental health problems, but if you don't have the money to afford rent in San Francisco, you're homeless, right? Mm-hmm. So, and you can have full abstinence, have no substance abuse, just out of work or too old to get a job, can't get a job in this market, you're homeless. So it's a mixture of populations, but we don't even have one. We need to have like some entire hotels, small hotels a city could purchase, like 30 room hotels that have never worked for our program, but would work for an intensive needs that we need. And the city needs to go in that direction.
Are there any other ways in which the structure of how our society deals with people who are displaced could be reorganized to diminish the even cause of homelessness? Of course, we've talked about before, providing public housing, providing government subsidized housing. What about other ways of providing income or supplemental income to people who are on the margins economically?
Well, San Francisco is talking about a guaranteed income. I think Oakland's talking about it. And that's obviously what's needed in this country. People don't have to have the amount of money you have when you're living in one of our hotels, the amount of money you have left is very little in an expensive city like San Francisco. But it really, when you don't have a place to live, it really ripples. It affects your education, it affects your health care, it affects every part of your life because you don't have a place to live. And your mental health, and no matter how healthy you are when you start homelessness, you're there long enough out on the street, you deteriorate. And so we need to get through this, but it has to start with a massive infusion of more. What I would say, if public housing isn't politically viable, there's a social housing bill in the California legislature, it needs to pass, and they need to start building because we need, hundreds of thousands of units. We don't even have the supply. Even if we gave every homeless person a Section 8 voucher in San Francisco, they wouldn't be able to use most of them because there's no place for them to live.
Do you feel there's too much means testing in who actually gets to get housing?
I don't think that's a problem with the population we're talking about. It's just the lack of income to support the rents in places. And again, all of our units are subsidized, and San Francisco has been more fortunate than other cities because it's a wealthy city to fund subsidies. But, the federal government, if you think of this, you guys, over 80% of the people in America eligible for federal housing assistance do not get it.
Wow.
Now, wait a minute. 80%. Now, just think, if you don't get it and you're eligible, isn't it pretty likely you end up being either in an overcrowded unit or homeless? So why are we surprised? It used to be that 80% eligible got subsidized housing. We've gone completely reverse.
Now, what do you say to, we had a young lady on, oh, it was sometime last year, Pascal. I remember Tracy Rosenthal that wrote a really good piece. Was it the New Left Review she wrote that piece in about permanent supportive housing not necessarily being permanent? Because sometimes the leases come up.
Well, ours are permanent. No one ever has to leave. And that's why so many stay till they, die. But there's always things like Section 8 certificates she may have mentioned because the landlord can always reject it if it's a private. Let me just mention that if people ever use Twitter on this show, you can follow me at Beyond Cron, in case people are interested in.
There should be wherever anyone's listening or watching the show. There are definitely links in the description to Randy's article and of course Randy's website, Beyond Chrono.
Let me mention one other point is I'm sensing right now in this country, and particularly in the West Coast, a real public impatience. They feel like they've dealt with, you know, homelessness for so long, and they're very frustrated, and so they turn against the people trying to help the homeless and house the homeless. It's like, well, you're an industrial complex. You're just keeping people homeless because that's your business. Well, actually, all of our people are housed, so we don't house everyone. Everyone we house is a housed person. But the challenge we have is that when you don't spend money to solve a problem for 40 years, it gets worse, right? And so people just assume, well, the homeless has been with us so much, money must not be the answer. Money is the answer. We've never gotten the money. The federal government's never spent the money. And people just need to do that instead of just blaming the person right next to them or being mad at the person on the street, because they don't want to be on the street, most of them. They'd love to be in housing, as we learned from the SIP program when they suddenly made all these hotels available. Suddenly all these folks went to hotels. That seemed like a pretty proof point.
But do you feel part of the neoliberal project? And Pascal, I'd love to get your opinion on this as well. And definitely this goes out to the chat as well. Do you feel part of the neoliberal project is to individualize the problem? And it is these broken people that we just can't fix. Because it seems to be whenever I get some news from L.A., I'm not that far from a few hours away from L.A., and, you know, they definitely have a very similar homeless problem. But it feels like there's something about this stigmatized individual that's the problem. And everyone's looking for the perfect homeless person that they could just throw in a house and say, we'll see, we solved it. Oh, look, we built them a tiny little shack that if they fart in, it'll stay in there for a week and a half. And this is wonderful. We have a whole village of shacks. Isn't this wonderful? Don't you just want to put these ne'er-do-wells in Shacky Town? It feels like there's a patronizing pat on the head to a lot of the unhoused population and to the people that work in that industry. But it also feels like it's part of the project of the 50-plus year counter-revolution that starts during the Nixon administration.
I think you're absolutely correct, Jason, is that part of the whole project is to making it seem like all of these problems that are socially constructed as a result of the failures of capitalism under neoliberalism are the cause of individuals not living up to the expectations of what it means to be a functioning adult citizen in an economic paradigm that's really designed to cannibalize them.
You know, I wrote in my first book, The Activist Handbook, I described the strategy that occurred in San Francisco, and it affected a mayoral election in 91, where the idea was stop saying it's San Francisco's government's fault for not housing people, blame the individual. And this whole thing came around about blaming the individuals, never ended. You have places like the Manhattan Institute, which does City Journal. You have a whole industry of writers about blame the individual for homelessness. It's their own fault. They didn't take care of their lives. Well, wait a minute. Our society in Europe, they fund public housing for people. We don't do that here. So why is that their fault? But that has, when you're a conservative who doesn't want to spend money on a problem, blame the individual and convince yourself, no point spending money on homelessness. These people will just screw it up. And that's been the attitude, and it's the attitude of a lot of people today still.
Part of the problem is also is that it part of the conservative mind assumes that quote unquote human nature makes it unable for human beings to be able to render these kind of problems to themselves because their capacities are just too self-interested, and that for people to actually think that they can care about each other goes against what human nature tells us, and that people are individual motivated, as if people aren't socialized into the value systems that they have as a society. One of the reasons why I like to concentrate on the concept of ideological superstructure, in other words, the educational system, the social mechanisms, the media, the television, the cultural mechanisms, outside of simply the base, i.e. how profit and loss are made in capitalism, is that it creates the cultural milieu and echo chamber that allows for us to have such a coarse society where people become disposable. And there is a direct correlation between the way within the 50 plus year counter-revolution that capitalism moves to this carnivorous type of exploitative mechanism and the way in which we choose to move to rhetoric about individualism, underclass ideology, and dispose of people in ways that say it's their own fault. As if anyone comes out of a womb by themselves and breastfeeds themselves without having some kind of social connection to mechanisms that give them life. And this is one of the things that this kind of libertarian view of how capitalism works is so toxic about, and that it creates this charade that tells people that they are functioning on the, of their own accord, divorced by infrastructure, mechanisms, and all types of means that are coming together that give them the capacity to even be able to turn on a light bulb in this society.
Well, you make a great point, Pascal, because it's a brilliant strategy of capitalism to have everyone blame themselves rather than society for their problems, right? So if you think it's your fault, you don't go to protest, you don't go to vote, you don't go to organize, because what's the point? It's my fault. And that's how we work as a society. We always have it. It's always the individual's fault. Mm-hmm. And that really comes true in homelessness, an extreme case. But even with student loans, we're trying to get, you know, student loan debt repealed. And your people say, well, they shouldn't have taken out those loans. It's their own fault, right? Everything is everybody's fault. And it's a brilliant strategy that this country's occupied. It's been the dominant since the Reagan years, for sure. That's been the prevailing view, is that you get sick, you should have gotten private health care. That's your problem. You can't afford it, it's your fault. And
it's funny. It's interesting.
At the center of the core problem with America, our failure as a country, our failure to deal with community issues, public health issues, and it's really at the crucible of that.
There's a term, I didn't put it in my essay, and I didn't put it in the video essay, but basically if you think about, you know, going back to, and please check out the essay on Sublation Magazine. What you had left post the Watts riots, because people forget 65 is also the year after the Bracero program ends. So now you have an influx of extremely cheap undocumented labor competing with not as cheap black labor that has been kind of in the system since they arrived. You have what economists call, and Pascal, correct me if I'm wrong, useless eaters.
Oh, yeah. That was a very common term that comes about in the 80s.
And these useless eaters are ultimately what we're talking about. And it's the elderly who you see companies like Amazon use until you literally die on the shop floor. With people with mental illness, people that have been in the system for so long that maybe they don't get Social Security to be able to pay for an apartment, and now you're just a problem.
You know,
these people go some. They're people. They go somewhere.
Well, you know, I remember when I started working with Tenderwood in 1980. The seniors that I knew, they weren't homeless people in 1980 to 1001 that I, there were hardly, you know, a few down and outers, but the seniors all had senior housing. We used to build senior housing. Remember that? It was regularly built. And mm-hmm. Now we have projects, we don't get, as I said, 80% of the eligible beneficiaries don't get it. So we need just to have an affordable housing construction boom. And there are some bills in the California legislature now that could do social housing, could create that, but it takes time. And people are impatient. We have a mayor's race going on in Los Angeles right now, where in the city of Los Angeles, progressive Los Angeles, may elect a Republican billionaire. Have you followed that race?
I've been following a little bit. I'll tell you off air about someone in the race that Pascal and I definitely joke about. But I just saw that Bass is in it with who's the person?
Kevin De Leon.
De Leon, yes, thank you.
But the leader in the polls is Rick Caruso, who's a Republican shopping center owner, and now he calls himself an independent. He's backed Republicans. You remember L.A. did elect Dick Riordan, a previous multimillionaire, wasn't a billionaire, Because what happens is people are so frustrated by the problems, so they think, let's bring a businessman in. That'll solve them. Even though, of course, you know how that worked out with Reardon, not very well. But that's what happens when the Fed, when the public money isn't there and things deteriorate, like in LA, mm-hmm. people look for the businessman. So, you know, we'll see what happens. There'll probably be a runoff after June between him and Cameron Bass, but that should be alarming about what it says about what we're going to do with homelessness when you have a guy who has no history at all of supporting anything like that, reducing homelessness.
Well, isn't he part of the program to kind of do these big sweeps in a lot of these cities, part of the real estate lobby? Well,
sweeps have become Seattle. It's a huge problem in LA. And again, people say do something. And so if you say, well, I don't think it's productive to do sweeps because moving people from place to place doesn't matter, you're weak. We're going to elect this guy because he's going to solve the problem. We had that with Frank Jordan in the 1991 San Francisco election, ex-police chief. He's not going to let all this stuff happen. Made no difference. But it works as a political move. But the fact that we're still cities like Los Angeles are thinking of going in that direction is disturbing. It shows you that not funding public services, same way that people don't fund education so they can open private schools and more charter schools that are non-unionized. So, you know, defunding the public sector has been a very successful reactionary strategy in this country.
It's one of the core essences of neoliberalism off the cuff, is to basically believe that the function of the state or the government is superfluous and not only not necessary to be cut, but part of the actual problem, and that the private sector, who has no fiduciary responsibility to the citizenry, should be the caretaker of the affairs of its citizens. When they have no actual, they're not elected, they don't, you don't pay taxes to them, and they only respond to their board of directors and their shareholders. It's a very parasitic reality that we're still in right now, trying to find a way out of, that everyone in the world is reacting to, unfortunately, either with a pivot to fascism or trying to double down on, without any responding to how to get us out of this conundrum we're in, where neoliberalism has been choking the life out of most of Americans and most of the world for the large majority of my lifetime.
Yeah, you're right.
I do want to ask you before we go, there is a department, the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, that was founded. Was it 2016 that was founded?
Yes.
Is that a well-funded department, well-staffed, or is it just something that was funded to shut people up? I'm asking because I don't know.
Well, you see, this is what the article was confusing about a lack of accountability. They get their money from they need more money, and they support more money. They want more money, but it's up to the mayor and the controller to give them the money. Mm-hmm. They don't print bills there. They would agree with everything that we're saying about underfunding and everything, but that's why it really comes down to the mayor, the board of supervisors, and the controller, I've been pushing with all of those entities to create the money that's needed. We have a $74 million budget surplus, $74 million surplus in San Francisco. We can't pay workers fairly. We can't give money for capital improvements to fix up hotels, which they actually just did yesterday, gave some money. But we have the money to do this in San Francisco.
Well, they actually say in the article that your hotel got more money than other buildings, and they still had some maintenance problems.
That what did?
They said it was still maintenance problems. I thought I wrote down the quote.
The article talks about how the new, you know, we passed this ballot measure called Prop C, which really is going to make a huge difference. But the city attorney ruled that you can't use Prop C money on any hotels existing before it passed, because it only has to be new hotels. Okay. So they call them the legacy hotels, like the ones we run, are all really underfunded, and they have plenty of money for the new hotels. But we got 4,000 or 5,000 people living in the old hotels who need, and the staff for those hotels need help. So it's really a critical time. We'll know in a few weeks whether the budget in San Francisco takes it, that all these things that have been going on, all these stories, where they make a difference.
Somebody has made a statement here in the chat that I kind of want to address. I find this interesting. That's not it. Dang it. Can't find it now.
You remember it?
Yes, found it. Why is no one in California holding Newsom and those Dems accountable for blocking Medicare for all? First and foremost, the
California Nurses Association has been very vocal on that.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I want to say, what does that mean, holding Newsom accountable, and what can one individual do? This is beyond a tweet, and this is beyond yelling in front of somebody's house. Like, seriously, what organizations do you know of that weren't very vocal about their being extremely upset about it not even getting a floor vote?
I think the California Nurses Association, a lot of labor was very upset.
And they were actually very vocal about it, even posted. But it's a state issue. And if you are one that watches a lot of these shows or even news on a national level, it's just not something that's very fun and clickable. Because it gets caught up in the weeds of eventually how are you going to pay for it. But actually the bill that was going to be presented actually solved that, because even was it 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago.
I mean, 1 minute break. I'll be right back.
For sure. A bill was coming up for Medicare for all in California. Then actually the big pushback on that bill was, well, how are you going to pay for it? And that was when Jerry Brown was governor. So this bill actually answered those questions. But there definitely was a little bit of fear in bringing it to a vote, because people that were not on board because they were taking money from certain lobbies didn't want to.
I remember how disappointed you were that was not taken seriously. I thought it was a very serious, significant missed opportunity that people did not take the recognition of how it would have been such a radical transformative capacity and challenge to the inertia we have in this country around national healthcare, that California took the reins in providing healthcare for its citizens. And it was a debacle.
Yeah. Someone, the first fall will it dislodge the Dems supermajority? Yeah, it was actually threatening. And it would have been very bad in politically, strategy wise, in those people's minds. I'd love to hear Randy's response.
Well, let me tell you, I'm very involved with the state legislature because my organization, the 1001 House, is going to be sponsoring a bill, AB 2050, to stop speculator evictions under the Ellis Act, which is a disaster for tenants. And it's a huge problem. You can read about it. It's just speculators evicting long-term tenants in cities. It's outrageous. We talk about the Democratic supermajority, but many of those Democrats come from the Central Valley, Orange County, San Diego, where there's a very different kind of Democrats. I mean, it's a different world. I mean, I spend time today, we met with a legislator's aide from Rancho Cucamonga. You guys, can you visualize Rancho Cucamonga?
It's the one in Next Friday, Pascal.
Really?
It's the city in the movie Next Friday.
Okay.
I mean, the point is that there are cities that are in California that have representatives that many of your leaders, watchers here, can't even visualize, because it's a big state. So we know LA. I mean, every member of the LA delegation, every member of the Bay Area delegation is for us, but one, some of the South Bay are not. But then we have all these Democrats who are in everywhere, south of the Bay Area. Area until you get to LA County. And so the Democratic supermajority means that the Democrats there are very conservative, and they're owned by real estate interests and corporate interests, and they don't want to pass Medicare for all. I mean, that's the challenge. I mean, I think that I know there was criticism of not coming to a vote, but Ash Kalra, the sponsor of that bill, the lead sponsor, he's as progressive as anyone in the legislature. He didn't want to have it lose big because he thought it would look really bad. Now, he obviously should have communicated better with his groups. But this supermajority, it sounds really good. But when you start looking at the politics of those in that Democratic supermajority, it's not what you may think. It's different in Washington, where they're able, the way it works, Nancy Pelosi gets almost all the Democrats to vote for everything. It's not that way
the person said, well, don't people want Medicare for all? And it was called CalCare, so let's stop calling it Medicare for all. In Modesto And it's not about what people want. It's about what organizations can be mobilized to put pressure on politicians. Those are two totally different things.
That's where, like, we find that there's not a lot of tenant activism in Rancho Cucamonga, but there's a real estate, plenty of real estate offices. And there's not,
there's homeowners there. It's a bedroom community.
Yeah. The opponents of Medicare for All can fund races throughout the state. The proponents often don't have a strong presence in some of these Inland Empire, Central Valley districts, San Diego, Orange County, you know, very, they go with the property rights and with the corporate interests.
And again, when we, the areas that Randy is talking about are kind of, especially Orange County, is a series of bedroom communities and suburbs and strip malls everywhere. Like, and San Diego is also extremely conservative, and there's tons of homeowners in these places. So the homeowner lobby definitely is a whole different beast. And again, it's not about what individual people want. It's about what organized power do you have to push a politician or series of politicians or an agenda, because holding people accountable, I don't know what that means in the abstract of holding people. Like, I have no power to hold AMLO accountable for what I see in Tijuana when I have to cross the border, right?
You know, there's something interesting that I didn't know until I got so involved with trying to pass this bill. Like 20% of the legislature, they have relatives, family members who are in the legislature. So you have people who, they didn't have to work. They were set up to follow their brother, father, you know, with the same political donors. And their kids can follow as well. So it's a very, people could look at that. It's hard to hold them accountable in California, frankly.
We'll see. I think the mood is changing. I think there's more people like the person that left that comment that definitely are angry and want to get involved and actually want to make changes. I think we're seeing it with young people unionizing their workspaces, understanding the power they have collectively. That's my hope.
Well, I'm very optimistic. I'll just conclude by saying that I appreciate the opportunity to talk to everyone, and they should read the article at beyondcron.org and support funding for nonprofits doing this very difficult work, because it's extremely difficult. And with COVID, a lot of people don't want to come to work. They want to work at home, but these hotel jobs, you got to come to the hotel and be in the hotel. You know how it is, Jason. You can't do it from your home. You can't provide support services from your home.
I will leave with this image. The county came to do an audit at the hotel, and not one county worker, and mind you, our kind of common space where workers were was sectioned off, just stanchioned off. Everybody was pretty respectful of space. And we had masks, KN95s, and gloves if we really needed it. But when the county came, they had the full shields, they had gowns, they had head covering, they had shoe covering. It looked like they were going, it was looked like Silkwood. So they wouldn't go into a room to stand in the doorway to say, okay, there's this there, there's this there, there's this there. You know, they wouldn't, without all that on. The young lady, a personal friend of mine, that was opening the door for them, all she had was a mask. Just to give you an idea of, you know, how workers are treated. You know, so we are going after this, guys. If you are a patron, meet us in the patron bonus champagne room. Randy, can you stay with us for like at least 10, 15 minutes?
Yes, I can stay 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. Pascal, you can stick around for a few more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. I definitely want to live chat with you guys. I definitely want to hear what you guys have to say. Hear your takes. I want to hear your guys' experiences. The great thing about this show is I think that we have connected with enough people that have worked in this world as well, worked in unhoused services, worked in mental health services. I want to hear your stories. Let's have a conversation. Maybe we can come up with some ideas. So thank you guys. Randy, thank you very much.
Always. Again,
the article, these articles posted in the description of the show. Please read it.
My favorite show to be on, always, Jason. Thank you.
Oh, dude, that warms my heart. So thank you guys very much, and we are out. Thank you.